Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Ahead of UN Chief Antonio Guterres' visit to Moscow and Kyiv this week to push for peace in Ukraine, latest data from the UN refugee agency UNHCR shows that more than 5.2 million people have now left the war-shattered country. Nearly 1.2 million have also crossed back into Ukraine, but UNHCR stressed that these numbers were by no means fixed or sustainable, as the situation across Ukraine remains highly volatile and unpredictable. Poland remains the leading refugee country, with nearly 3 million people from Ukraine, followed by Romania hosting around 780,000 and Russia at more than 605,000. Many millions more remain uprooted inside Ukraine, where fighting continues to rage in the eastern Donbass region and shelling has reportedly picked up again in the eastern city of Kharkiv. UN-appointed independent rights experts on Monday urged the United States to end its freeze on Afghanistan's foreign assets. The Dar Afghanistan Bank has more than $7 billion in blocked reserves that could be used to provide desperately needed humanitarian relief to tens of millions in the country, said the experts. In February, President Biden renewed a previous decision to block this cash. The rights experts appealed to Washington, saying that humanitarian exemptions to sanctions in Afghanistan, which the UN Security Council agreed last December, has led to no significant progress in financial or commercial aid to Afghanistan, as many foreign banks were too worried about breaching restrictions in place. The experts, including Elena Duan, Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures, called on all countries to reassess any unilateral measure imposed since the Taliban takeover last August. To Singapore now, where the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, called on Monday for a stay of execution for two Malaysian nationals accused of drug offences. The execution of Nagendran Dharmalingam and Dachinamurthy Kataya is imminent, said OHCHR spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani, who pointed to an alarming acceleration in execution notices in Singapore since the start of the year. Dharmalingam was arrested in 2009 and convicted of drug trafficking. His family was told last week that he was due to be executed this Wednesday, despite dismissed appeals claiming he had an intellectual disability and denied requests for clemency. Kataya was arrested in 2011 and convicted of dimorphine trafficking charges into Singapore. Last week, his family received notice that his execution was scheduled for this Friday. After a pause in executions of more than 2 years, on the 30th of March, Singapore executed Abdul Khair bin Othman following his conviction for drug-related offences, and 50 others are currently reportedly on death row in the country. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Yes, listeners, come up. Stay with us if you're in listening now. Check it out. John Grant at the top of the second hour on This Can't Be Happening Tuesdays. First, the headlines from Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, and then Counterspin with Janine Jackson.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres travels to Moscow today to meet at the Kremlin with Russia's foreign minister and its president, Vladimir Putin. His trip comes as the UN struggles to bring humanitarian relief to civilians trapped by Russia's assault on eastern Ukraine. Guterres will again press Russian and Ukrainian troops to silence their guns after his previous calls for a ceasefire went unheard. heated. After the Secretary General's visit to Moscow, Russia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations said a truce was unlikely.
So we don't think that ceasefire is a good option right now, because the only advantage it will give possibility for Ukrainian forces to regroup.
Moldova's president has convened an emergency meeting of her nation's Supreme Security Council after a series of explosions rocked a region near Ukraine's southern border that's home to a pro-Russia separatist movement. Early this morning, twin explosions destroyed a Soviet-era radio tower that was used to broadcast Russian programs across Moldova. Elsewhere, unknown assailants fired grenades at a state security building in the provincial Moldovan capital of Transnistria. The region in eastern Moldova is home to pro-Russia separatists, and Russian troops have been permanently based there since the collapse of the Soviet Union. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's visiting Germany's Ramstein Air Base today, joining officials from more than 40 countries for U.S.-hosted talks on providing military support to Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov responded by accusing NATO of fighting a proxy war against Russia. On Monday, three NATO warships arrived at a port in southwestern Finland, less than 200 miles from Russia's border. Sweden and Finland have reportedly agreed to submit simultaneous membership applications to join NATO as early as the middle of next month. In Norway, police arrested 20 protesters Monday after they blocked a massive shipment of Russian oil from reaching shore. Members of Greenpeace held signs reading "Oil Fuels War" as they chained themselves to the anchor chain of the massive Ust-Luga oil tanker, which was waiting to offload nearly 100,000 metric tons of fuel to a terminal operated by ExxonMobil. This is Frode Flem, head of Greenpeace Norway.
This oil tanker is fully loaded with Russian oil bonded for the Esso terminal ashore here in Norway. Greenpeace is demanding from Esso and Norwegian government to ensure that this Russian oil is not imported to Norway. It fuels Putin's war in Ukraine. It's wrong.
In more climate news, about 4,000 protesters rallied in the village of Lützerath in western Germany over the weekend, seeking to halt the expansion of a massive open-pit coal mine. The village is set to be demolished to make way for the nearby Garzweiler mine, which produces brown coal or lignite, one of the world's dirtiest fossil fuels. The world's richest man, Elon Musk, is set to become the new owner of Twitter after the company's board agreed to sell the influential social media platform for $44 billion. The deal is expected to close later this year, pending regulatory approval. The watchdog group Media Matters criticized Musk's takeover of Twitter, saying it'll be a, quote, victory for disinformation and the people who peddle it, unquote. At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said President Biden was concerned about Musk's takeover.
No matter who owns or runs Twitter, the president has long been concerned about the power of large social media platforms, the power they have over our everyday lives, has long argued that tech platforms must be held accountable for the harms they cause. He has been a strong supporter of fundamental reforms to achieve that goal, including reforms to Section 230, enacting antitrust reforms, requiring more transparency, and more.
We'll have more on Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter later in the broadcast. We'll speak with the first employee of the company that created Twitter, as well as Jessica Gonzalez of Free Press. Nicaragua is withdrawn from the Organization of American States and has expelled OAS representatives from the country. The OAS says the move is a, quote, violation of the most basic international norms and that Nicaragua cannot leave the organization until 2023. Nicaragua has long accused the OAS of being a tool for U.S. intervention. This is Nicaragua's foreign minister.
We ratify our unwavering decision to leave the Organization of American States, as expressed on November 19, 2021, and by confirming our irrevocable denunciation and resignation before this calamitous, truculent, and lying dependency of the State Department of Yankee imperialism.
El Salvador has extended a state of emergency that was imposed a month ago by another 30 days, despite reports of serious human rights violations. The crackdown was enacted due to rising homicides attributed to gangs. The order suspends freedom of assembly, weakens due process rights for those arrested, extends the time people can be held without charge. The Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele, says over 18,000 accused gang members have been detained. Residents of the capital, San Salvador, say everyone is being targeted.
The people are being affected, not only the bad guys, but also good people. Children are being frisked, and I think this means rights violations.
They arrest anyone. They arrest people because of the way they dress or their hairstyle. It's a matter of luck. They have even detained elderly people.
A federal judge in Louisiana has temporarily blocked the Biden administration from ending Title 42, a Trump-era policy that's allowed the U.S. government to expel asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border without due process. The Biden administration planned to end Title 42 by next month, facing backlash from both Republicans and Democrats. Since Title 42 was first invoked in March 2020, over 1.7 million asylum seekers have been expelled from the U.S. and returned to places where they face kidnapping, torture, sexual assault, or threats to their lives. Chinese authorities have ordered 3.5 million residents of Beijing's most populous district to undergo mass testing for COVID-19. The order set off a run on grocery stores as residents fear they may soon suffer the same fate as Shanghai, where some 25 million people have been shut in their homes for weeks. Another 30 million people in Chinese cities outside Shanghai and Beijing also remain on lockdown. China recently reported its highest rates of community spread since the start of the pandemic as it struggles to enforce its zero COVID strategy. In Hong Kong, the Foreign Correspondents Club has postponed its annual Human Rights Journalism Awards over concerns the event could violate a sweeping national security law imposed by Chinese authorities in Beijing. Washington Post correspondent Shabani Matani resigned from the Correspondent Club's Press Freedom Committee in protest. She told the Financial Times, quote, "It's emblematic of the self-censorship many institutions feel forced to subject themselves to in today's Hong Kong and entirely indicative of how the national security law has changed the landscape for all," unquote. In Turkey, a court has sentenced businessman and civil society leader Osman Kavala to life in prison without the possibility of parole in a decision condemned by human rights groups. Seven co-defendants each received 18-year prison terms. Kavala has been jailed in pretrial detention since 2017 after he was arrested on charges related to the 2013 Rezi Park protests. He was also accused of organizing a failed coup against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's government in 2016. Kavala's supporters gathered outside a courthouse in Istanbul Monday as his life sentence was handed down.
If this was a lawful decision, we would be able to comment on it. But it is not. This is the culmination of the government's revenge against the Gezi Park protesters. This is the execution of orders coming from the Turkish president.
Amnesty International condemned the harsh sentences for Kavala and his co-defendants. The group said in a statement, quote, "Today we've witnessed a travesty of justice of spectacular proportions. This verdict deals a devastating blow not only to Osman Kavala, his co-defendants, and their families, but to everyone who believes in justice and human rights activism in Turkey and beyond," Amnesty International said. A New York judge has found Donald Trump in civil contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a subpoena from Attorney General Letitia James asking for records on the Trump Organization's business dealings. The court ordered Trump to pay $10,000 each day he fails to turn over the records. Trump's lawyers have promised to appeal the order. New York State Attorney General James has been investigating whether the Trump Organization inflated the values of its properties to obtain loans and then reduced them to evade taxes. A new study finds prosecutions of corporate criminals have hit a record low under President Joe Biden, worsening a trend that saw corporate immunity set records under President Trump. Public Citizen reports the number of corporate prosecutions in fiscal year 2021 dropped to just 90, or less than half the average rate over the previous quarter century. Meanwhile, human rights and environmental lawyer Steve Donziger has just been released from nearly 1,000 days of house arrest. Donziger's legal ordeal began after he successfully sued Chevron on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorian Amazonian indigenous people for dumping 16 billion gallons of oil into their ancestral land. We'll speak with Stephen Donziger later in the broadcast. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has granted a stay of execution for Melissa Lucio and ordered a lower court to consider new evidence of Lucio's innocence in the death of her 2-year-old daughter, Mariah. Lucio was scheduled to die Wednesday. Now she may get a new trial. Her attorneys say Lucio, who's a survivor of a lifetime of abuse, was pressured to make a false confession and did not get a fair trial. On Monday, the Texas Tribune recorded as State Representative Jeff Leach spoke by phone with Lucio to break the news. He was talking to her on death row.
You haven't heard the news yet?
No, what happened?
The Court of Criminal Appeals issued a stay of your execution for Wednesday.
Are you serious?
We just got word about 15 minutes ago.
Oh, my God. That is wonderful. Oh, my God.
On Monday, members of Melissa Lucio's family gathered at the Gatesville prison north of Austin, where they celebrated news of the reprieve. This is Melissa Lucio's son, John.
It's been 15 long years, you know, and so we say that ourselves, I mean, God forbid, I mean, but if it takes another 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, it really don't matter. I mean, we're going to hug her regardless, you know, and I mean, it'll be soon because she won't be on death row much longer, and we'll have more likely physical contact.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, news media coverage of taxes falls broadly into two camps. There are, especially in April, lots of news you can use type stories, like NBC's Today show warning viewers to be mindful of typos and not to be lazy about filing for extensions. Or NBC Nightly News noting that if you filed by mail, you might wait 5 to 8 months for your return due to backlogs at the IRS. Taxes, in other words, as in, oh, well, what are you going to do sort of thing that all of us have to deal with. Then there are other disconnected stories about tax policy. Who pays, how much, and why? We've talked about that a fair amount on this show, and we're going to revisit two of those conversations today. Last April, we spoke with Emory College law professor and author Dorothy A. Brown about how, though you can scour tax policy and find no mention of race, our tax system still affects black people very differently in ways most conversation obscures. And in February of 2019, we spoke with economist Dean Baker about why the idea of raising taxes on the super wealthy makes sense to many mainstream economists and to the general public, but still faces a perennial headwind in corporate media. Two revelatory conversations about tax policy this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In the United States today, the median white family, not average, but median, half above, half below, has a net worth, that means wealth or assets minus debts or liabilities, 8 times that of the median black family. That's the same gap as 40 years ago. Despite gains that black people have made in income and education and all of the things that you do to accrue wealth. So what's going on and what does it have to do with our system of taxation? In April of 2021, we spoke with Dorothy A. Brown. She's Asa Griggs Candler Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law and author of the book The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. I asked her, first of all, to address the fact that although black people are underpaid generally and shuttled into work sectors that are underpaid, employment income, how much money comes in, is different from tax policy, though they are related.
That's right. So, you know, how much income we have helps inform how much we owe in taxes. But what my research showed is when black and white Americans engage in the same activity, whether it's work, whether it's owning a home, whether it's getting married, whether it's paying for college, tax policies subsidize the way white Americans engage in the activity while disadvantaging the way black Americans engage in the activity.
Well, so let's just get into that a little more. What are some of the ways that that works, that that happens?
Well, we can start with what you talked about, which jobs. So we know that there's occupational segregation, right? Some jobs are disproportionately filled by white Americans, and other jobs are disproportionately filled by black Americans. But there are tax subsidies associated with jobs. Think employer-provided retirement accounts. Any money that the employer puts in a retirement account, any money you put in a retirement account, is not taxed today, even though it's wage income. It will be taxed later when you retire and withdraw the amount. And presumably in 20, 30, 40 years when you retire, you won't be working, and the amount of income taxes you pay on that retirement amount will be less,
right?
If you were to take the money today, add it to your other wage income, you'd be paying higher taxes. So it's a big tax break. Well, what we know are jobs that are disproportionately held by white Americans are more likely to come with retirement benefits. But even when a black American is fortunate enough to get such a job, we are less likely to participate and contribute to that benefit. And if we are able to participate to that retirement account, we're more likely to withdraw an amount early that's subject to a tax penalty. So how does this happen? Research shows black college graduates are more likely to send money to their parents or grandparents to help them pay for necessities, whereas white college graduates are more likely to receive money from their parents and grandparents that could help them with a down payment for a home, pay for K-12 private school for their children, so that even if, miraculously, we were to find a white American and a black American making the same amount, we know that doesn't happen, right, because of race discrimination in the labor market. But even if we find that, the black worker, because their parents and grandparents suffered under Jim Crow, is going to be more likely to have less after-tax dollars because they're going to send some money home.
Right. You know, Jeremy Greer from the Corporation for Enterprise Development told me, income helps you get by, but wealth helps you get ahead and allows you to think about the future. And it's so critical. And if you don't have to think of it that way, well, then you don't think of it that way, you know?
That's right.
You know, and that's – so, okay, well, okay, that's just the law is what we would hear, you know. And yet we see corporations write tax law favorable to themselves. We see Congress carve out exceptions or offer rebates for specific individual companies, like it looks like sausages being made. And yet we're somehow disinclined to think that that corruption and cronyism might include systemic racism.
Absolutely. And part of the problem is the IRS doesn't collect or publish statistics based on race. So people can walk around saying tax law is colorblind because when you go to the IRS statistics, it has nothing up there dealing with race. In fact, I've been writing in this area for a couple of decades, and the typical white tax law professor ignores what I say or pushes back or marginalizes what I say because their response is, there's nothing in the code about race. There's nothing in tax law about race, which ignores the disparate impact based on race. I mean, we've seen this in Georgia with voting rights. There's nothing in the Republican passed legislation that's going to make it harder for black people to vote that says, black people, we want it to be harder for you to vote.
Right.
But we all know that's going to be the impact and that that was the intent behind the law. So the notion that you have to have a law say we discriminate against black people before we can find the law actually discriminates against black people defies logic and history.
And, you know, everyone, everyone, I use the term loosely, but people agree that black people are behind, are disadvantaged, whatever their explanation for that is.
Yes.
But then when it comes time to intervene to allow, not help, but allow to stop preventing black people getting ahead, it becomes a whole different conversation that's about the intervention and its unfairness. And I just wanted to ask you, why have previous policy responses failed to adequately address the wealth gap, and then what sort of responses could?
So, you know, we have a lot of research on the wealth gap, and we have proposals for how to address it. But part of the problem is you have the left and the right seeing different causes of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have quarreled with both. The left sees this mainly as a function of historical discrimination that it's brought into the 21st century. The right sees it as bad behavior on the part of black Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? So the left gets it wrong in this instance. Yes, it was historical discrimination, but the reason why wealth doesn't work the same way for white Americans as black Americans today is because of choices white people make. So let's take homeownership. Most white homeowners live in neighborhoods with very few black Americans. That's how they like it. That's what the research shows. So progressive whites who live in neighborhoods with virtually no black neighbors are part of why homeownership builds more wealth for white Americans than black Americans. Because black Americans typically live in racially diverse or all black neighborhoods, and the homes are not valued as greatly as the exact same home in an all-white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because white prospective home buyers don't want to live in those neighborhoods, so they're not valued as high. So that's not historical discrimination. That's 21st century today discrimination by white homeowners.
Right.
On the other side, we have the right that says, well, black people just need to act more like white people. We need to get married. We need to buy homes. I've already told you why buying a home isn't the ticket to wealth for black Americans the way it is white Americans, but getting married. My research shows that when white people get married, they're more likely to get a tax cut. How? Because the tax law favors married couples with one single wage earner. One person who works in the paid labor market, the other person who works at home. That couple gets a tax cut. Couples like my parents, my mother was a nurse, my father was a plumber, they made roughly equal amounts. They don't get a tax cut. And for decades, they paid higher taxes. So you have conservatives saying, black people, you just need to get married. And my research shows, well, when we do, we don't get a tax cut.
Right.
So part of the road to a solution is really understanding the problem. And one of the key pieces that I make in my book is the system of America for building wealth is designed for white wealth. It's designed for how white Americans engage in their activities, whether it's marriage or buying a home, in a way that black Americans simply cannot replicate. And until we come to terms with our racist wealth-building system, no solution is going to fix it.
Well, let me ask you, finally, you've been working on this for a while, and you've seen the interest in the topic or even the belief that it is a topic shift.
Yes.
After George Floyd's murder, you say in this Bloomberg Businessweek piece from March, suddenly people wanted to talk about race and tax. I don't want you to burn any bridges with reporters, but I am curious, when you talk to media, where do you have to start? Do you find people disbelieving? Are they ready to see that this is real? And it doesn't have to be media, but just the general public. Do you feel like the moment's right to push this forward?
I do, and I will say this. Post George Floyd, the reporters who have called me have been terrific and have been in a listening mode. They have not been in an argumentative mode. Mm-hmm. I will say pre-George Floyd, white reporters that I've talked to, that I've tried to talk about race, have been very dismissive. And they're different people. Those people did not come back to me post-George Floyd, right?
Okay.
The people who came to me were all new white reporters who I hadn't talked to before, who actually saw the moment and wanted to get better informed. So that's kind of heartening, to be honest with you. I haven't had the pushback. And I will say over the years, the audiences that gave me the most comfort were the general public audiences.
Mm-hmm.
They were hungry for what I had to say and curious and were listening and attentive. It was the white academics who didn't want to hear anything I had to say. So the general public has always been an encouragement for me in doing this work.
We've been speaking with Dorothy Brown, Asa Griggs Candler Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law. The book is The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. It's out now from Crown. Thank you so much, Dorothy Brown, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dorothy A. Brown speaking with Counterspin in April of 2021. One in three GoFundMe campaigns in this country are for medical expenses, and one in five households have zero or negative wealth. And this is the same society in which there are also some people who can't remember how many houses they own. Inequality is a life or death issue, which makes it especially worrying that some people with media megaphones seem proudly ignorant of the basic mechanisms by which resources are distributed. And some of those myths and misunderstandings were thrown into relief in early 2019 when we saw a rather bold, for recent times, conversation about progressive taxation, occasioned by proposals from New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others. We spoke with Dean Baker, co-founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I asked him, first of all, to talk a bit about top marginal tax rates and increased taxes on extreme wealth in the wake of a proposal from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez suggesting the idea of a top marginal tax rate of 70%, as well as wealth tax proposals from Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, which had been received by media as though they were ideas from Mars.
The reaction to both proposals has been fascinating, both the public reaction where there's clearly been a lot of support. People are saying, yeah, you have a lot of real rich people. Why shouldn't they pay more in taxes? But more so from the media and, you know, from some establishment politicians. So the reaction is, oh, here's flaky Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, where she'd get off 70%. And in fact, that's a number that many of the world's most prominent tax economists have said. This is the maximum tax rate. You can, maximum tax rate in the sense maximum amount of revenue. And there was an article, widely read article, by Peter Diamond, who's a professor at MIT, and Manuel Saez, who's at Berkeley, both very, very prominent. Diamond won Nobel Prize, Saez, John Bates Clark Award, two of the most prestigious awards you can get in the profession. So these are people in very high standing. And they came up with that number. You know, and there were all sorts of qualifications and reservations, but in any case, they didn't think it was ridiculous. So when you have a fresh new member of Congress propose that, well, the media jumped on that like, oh, she's just being flaky. And in fact, it's a very reasonable thing to put on the table, whether that's the right rate. You know, of course, you could debate that, but it certainly was not a ridiculous proposal. And, you know, again, Paul Krugman had a very nice piece where he's contrasting that with the Republican proposals to cut taxes on the rich, where they were saying that they would pay for themselves, which was ridiculous, but that was treated like these are serious people. So it's been fascinating that there's been such a rush to dismiss these as kind of far-out proposals by radical leftists when they're reasonable proposals, which, again, is not to say that they're necessarily the best policy, but they're certainly reasonable proposals to put on the table and to be debated.
Well, we read that Michael Dell, who has $30 billion or so at the World Economic Forum, apparently said, name a country where that's worked ever, the 70% top marginal rate. Missing something, you could say.
Yeah, of course, the one of his co-panelists said the United States, because that was, in fact, the rate in the United States until Ronald Reagan lowered it with his tax cuts in 1981. And if we go back a little further, it was 90% in the Eisenhower days. Kennedy had lowered it to 70%. So, again, one could argue whether these are the best rates, but to treat this as a crazy idea out of, you know, far left field is just wrong. And, you know, some of the back and forth, because I was on Twitter with Dell and, you know, there were others involved, obviously. And what I find most striking here, Dell's kind of a poster child here, because what is Dell's expertise in this area? He's very rich, no doubt about that, but he obviously knows nothing about tax rates. I mean, again, we could disagree 70% the right rate, but to act like that's just impossible, we're going to see our economy collapse, that's nuts. He knows nothing about it. He just has $30 billion, so therefore he thinks he's qualified to talk about it.
Well, it's good, I think, that we're talking about taxing extremely high incomes and wealth for all kinds of reasons. The LA Times' Michael Hiltzik was saying, you know, it helps move us away from this notion that wealth is self-made, you know, that these folks owe nothing to society, and it disrupts the fallacy of trickle-down. But having said that, it does take the form of a give-back. You know, you've got an absurd amount of money, so you should throw some back in the pot because that's the socially decent thing to do. You suggest in this recent piece for Truthout that while that is not wrong, it's not getting to the crux, the bigger source of the rise in inequality.
Yeah, so the point I made in that piece, and really I've made in much of my writings over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, is that the distribution of income is not something that just happens. It depends on how we structure the economy. And I would say the economy is pretty much infinitely malleable. We could structure it all sorts of different ways. And my favorite example here, just because it's so blatant, is I like to say, how rich would Bill Gates be if he didn't have copyright or patent monopolies on Windows software? So if anyone in the world could just start producing, mass producing computers and copy in Windows and all the other Microsoft software, and they don't even have to send them a thank you note. Well, needless to say, he would not be one of the richest people in the world. He wouldn't have $100 billion. I'm sure he'd do fine, but, you know, the fact that someone like Bill Gates could become incredibly wealthy was because of how we designed that market. And it's pretty much the same story everywhere you look. Finance, where would all these Goldman Sachs guys be if we didn't have the bailout in 08 and we just let the market run its course? I mean, there's many other ways we subsidize finance as well. Corporate CEOs, they were always well paid, but if you go back to the pay standards of the 60s and 70s, they'd be getting $2 or $3 million a year, not $30 and $40 million. So we structure rules that allow people to get incredibly wealthy. And I really prefer that to be the focus, both because as a practical matter, it's much harder to get the money back once they have it. I mean, there's all sorts of practical issues that people have rightly raised. You know, when Elizabeth Warren says, let's tax the wealth, well, they're not just going to hand it over to you. It's going to be hard to do. It doesn't say it's not something we might want to do, but it's going to be hard. And secondly, the political issue. If we act as though, well, you know, Bill Gates got that fair and square, we shouldn't take any of it back. If you go, well, we could have kind of structured it differently, and then Bill Gates wouldn't have it, and then we don't even have to have this discussion.
I wonder, do you think it's a trap to talk about these things in terms of revenue, in terms of how much money it would bring to the economy? I read a piece by Vanessa Williamson from Brookings where she said that taxes on the very wealthy should be judged by their societal impact and not simply by their revenues, that it has to do with the fact that just having some people be so wildly wealthy is incompatible with democracy. And so we shouldn't get too hung up on how much money it would give to the economy to institute some of these changes. What do you make of that?
I think it's a very important point. And I remember some years ago, there was a piece on the estate tax that was done by Alicia Minnell, who's now at Boston College. And she came up with some figure that we get a relatively small amount of revenue, you know, from the estate tax. I'm saying relatively small. It's still substantial, but much less than if you just said, oh, here's how many rich people died, and we tax it at a 40% rate. Here's what we get a very small amount relative to that. But she wasn't writing it as a critic of the tax, because the two points she was making, one is exactly this one. The part of the story is we don't want massive amounts of wealth to be handed down, so you get Donald Trump or his kid, you know, walking away with billions and suddenly having all this political influence. But the other is, part of what they do to avoid the tax is do things like start foundations, like the Ford Foundation and the Gates Foundation. Now, those aren't my dreams. I mean, there's a lot of bad things I could say about the way those foundations are run, but the point is that's not altogether a loss for society because they do some good things. So to act like, oh, they aren't going to pay the tax, they're just going to start a foundation that provides inoculations to children in Africa, well, that's not a bad thing. So to just look at it and say, okay, how much revenue are we getting from the tax, that is missing the point.
Well, and then, though, going back to Michael Dell, he said, you know, my wife and I set up a foundation, and we would have contributed quite a bit more than a 70% tax rate on my annual income, and I feel much more comfortable with our ability as a private donation to allocate those funds than I do giving them to the government.
Well, I guess what I'd have to tell to Michael Dell, he still could do that.
Exactly. But I think what people are saying is the problem isn't whether that's true in real numbers. The problem is running a society on noblesse oblige, you know.
Yeah, no, we don't want to have to depend on, you know, I wasn't going to go into my criticisms of the Gates Foundation and the others, but yeah, we don't want to depend on their goodwill. I mean, people need health care, they need education, you know, all the other necessities of life, and it shouldn't depend on whether Michael Dell's, he and his wife are good people and they're going to contribute to that. I mean, it's nice if they want to, but that shouldn't be what we depend on.
Well, a poll from that Pinko Rag Business Insider showed that Ocasio-Cortez's proposal, the 70% top marginal tax rate, was more popular than the GOP tax cuts, which you alluded to before. People don't even think that socialism is a curse word anymore, which removes a real arrow from some folks' quiver. But I think we want to say that none of these proposals working on pre-tax income, post-tax income, they're not opponents of one another as proposals, right? And other things like raising the minimum wage could fit in there too. I guess it just does seem like more ideas are on the table than we've grown accustomed to, and I wonder how we keep that window open and how we keep pushing for more.
Well, it has been great that, you know, you have people put it on the table and there's been a good popular response. And I have to say, to some extent, our best allies under this have been the Republicans, the conservatives, because they've said things that are just so absurd. I mean, I remember Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, was criticizing Ocasio-Cortez's 70% proposal, and he's talking to his account. He's talking to fifth graders, and he says, so you do some work for your grandmother, and she gives you $10, and the government takes $7 of it. And he goes, and they all go, that's not fair. Of course, it has nothing to do with her proposal. She's talking about people who get over $10 million, so over $10 million. And so I don't know whether Scott Walker literally doesn't understand a marginal tax rate, or he's just being dishonest about it, but he publicized this, and needless to say, he got raked over the coals for it. My guess is he won't do that again. but it has certainly pushed the window on how we could talk about these things. So in that sense, we don't all have to agree that A, B, or C is the best, or, you know, what I would say is we probably want a mix of A, B, and C. But in any case, it certainly expanded the window of discussion in a really positive way.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker. He is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They're online at CEPR.net, and that's where you can also get hold of Dean's free book called Rigged. His piece, Progressive Taxes Only Go So Far, Pre-Tax Income is the Problem, can be found at truthout.org. Dean Baker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine. Good to be on again.
That was Dean Baker from February of 2019. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Divina la ilusión que me trajiste para sentirte tuya, tuya tú como ninguna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Yo siento tus amarras como garfios, como garras que se ahogan en la playa de la farsa y el dolor. Y siento tus amarras arrastrar en mi noche callada que sea plenilunada, azul como ninguna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Querida, que está triste y está sola, al menos tu recuerdo ponga luz sobre mi bruma. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna.
Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the backseat, too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? I'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. Just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while, but I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
And you can listen to the latest Radio EcoShock coming up tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas. Well, at the top of the hour, we're going to have John Grant. I can't wait to put him on. We'll see if we can get him on here. That was a Henry Mancini classic, Not From Dixie. But we're joined by John Grant, who inadvertently is from Dixie, Florida.
What? Hey, Mike, how you doing?
All right. You grew up there in Dixie, I think, didn't you?
I grew up in Florida. Yeah, I grew up in South Dade County, Florida, almost on the Keys. And we were the South Dade Rebels, and the Confederate flag was our banner. Yeah, those were the days, man.
I guess that was it is Dixie. So I did I changed the promo. I never, you know, I my brother, the truck driver, he lived. He told me that the Keys are not considered part of Florida. I don't know.
Well, I don't know where he gets that. They certainly aren't part of Cuba, you know. I mean, they're stuck on Florida up there. Yeah.
I don't know. He had it in his head that the Keys were just like a different world. It wasn't really like Florida. It wasn't Dixie.
First of all, whoa, you got to back up. Florida is very much a mix. It's not like Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia. You know, it's not the, quote, deep South, unless you're in the Panhandle, and I lived in the Panhandle, and that is, you know, deep South. You know, people come down from Alabama and Mississippi to Panama City, known as the Redneck Riviera. And, you know, that's all very deep South. But you get into central Florida and the coastlines, and it's very much transplanted Yankees and people from the north and like all that kind of thing. So it's a real mix of you know, refugees from the north, if you will, for, you know, coming down for the warm weather. And and so the building boom over the last 40 years has been incredible. I was just looking over the Google Maps of I'm planning a trip to South Dade, a sort of a nostalgic trip, to see what's left of what it was there when I was there. And, you know, it's incredible the amount of houses that have been jammed in, hundreds and hundreds of them, like a cancer coming south from Miami into that whole area of South Dade County. And so South Dade County was had its own sort of redneckism because, you know, Miami was a mangrove before the 20s. You know, it was carved out of mangrove in the early part of the 20th century. And the Keys only existed because of the Flagler Railroad, a very famous railroad, connected all those islands for 150 miles southwest of Miami. It's huge. Hurricanes, building the railroad was a major, major task. Flagler, a guy, built it. You know, so that's what connected the Keys, was a railroad. And we used to fish, when I got there in 58 as a 10-year-old kid, you know, the family would go down and fish on Long Key Bridge in the Keys, pulling in grunts and snappers and groupers and things. And that was an old railroad bridge. It was this very narrow bridge that had been once a railroad, and now they, you know, paved it over and made it into a two-lane highway. Well, now, you know, it's a four-lane highway going down into the Keys.
Oh, yeah.
Major, major development down there. And I don't think they've had a really big hurricane lately, so I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of the next hurricane, you know, the Gulf of Mexico will be dotted with trailers and mobile homes and things, you know. But
it's a strange state. I've only been there once, and it was like almost 50 years ago. It was over 50 years ago when I was there. And it was in Pensacola. And
okay, way the far end of the Panhandle, almost in Alabama or Mississippi over there.
Yeah, Yeah, right across the bay. We went and saw the, I want to say, it was a battleship. It was my uncle,
right.
He was in the Navy. He gave me a, the, it was almost boring. I mean, the.
Was that in Mobile?
Yeah, he took us to about the, across the bay. I think it's
right.
Called Across the Bay or something.
Of course, yeah.
But I was struck by that the beaches were still segregated, and so was the shopping hours in downtown Pensacola.
Sure.
Was like, you know, you don't go to downtown Pensacola at night, Mike.
Right.
You know, you only
go
to certain beaches.
This would have been the 50s or what?
No, this would have been like the mid-60s, late 60s, really, no kidding. And that was, but that was my uncle's, I think that was more my uncle's attitude than reality, frankly.
Right, sure.
I mean, we were too, I was too young, I couldn't drive.
Right.
So not that he'd loan me his car anyhow, but I mean, I sort of lost a lot of respect for him after my summer in Pensacola. he was busy trying to. He's dead now, so it doesn't matter. But he was too conventional for my taste. Even at 15 and 16 years of age, I could tell that he was too damn conservative for me. Even though he was in the Navy.
Right.
And seeing the world, he saw the world, you know.
Right, sure.
That's what he saw.
Huge Navy base in Pensacola, right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to familiarize listeners, some new ones that may have joined us, you know, with by opening the show up today with Henry Mancini's From Dixie. That was a classic, and I just thought, it's crime jazz. It's crime. I guess it's
I remember, you know, again, we had the Confederate flag, the South Dade Rebels, and, you know, we would play Dixie. The football games, they always had a big rousing presentation of Dixie. We'd play Dixie.
Kansas had that. Does not share that kind of history at all.
No.
And
no.
It's very easy. It's very easy to shame. Well, I don't know. I guess you can shame people still. It might not be politically correct anymore, but fuck it. In Kansas, you can shame people pretty easily about having Confederate flag license plates, Confederate flags in the front yard. I mean, it's just like you just don't do that in Kansas. I mean, you know, but in Florida, I remember that Florida, you got hell, they were sort of proud of it. They got away with it down there. That was another thing I learned in Pensacola that summer.
Well, Florida again, as a repeat, but it's a very complicated state. It's you know, not, again, like the deep South states that have a, you know, sort of a unified kind of image of themselves. I mean, Florida's just all over the map. I mean, on one text, it is like the capital of right-wing Latin America sort of sticking down to the Caribbean, you know. And so, with the Cubans who've taken over central Miami, I don't think you can survive in central Miami without speaking a little Spanish, you know. And, you know, so it's a very complicated place with politics right and left. And, you know, and then, of course, as I say, you got the old school, especially in South Dade County, which was an agricultural center, you know, 20 miles below Miami and before you get to the Keys. And, truck farming, squash, tomatoes, avocado, huge avocado groves, lime groves, huge packing plants in Homestead and Florida City. And, of course, in the summer, I picked limes. I would tear them. I mean, limes have spines that are like an inch and a half long. And you reach in there and you have short sleeves and you're not thinking. Yeah, I was lacerated with these things, and I'd get a quarter of field crate, I pick them, and you know, you get a field crate that'd give you a damn quarter for it. You know,
damn.
You know, and I'd be picking with migrants, Hispanics, and families, black families, and you got to know them a little bit, and you know, it's like it sort of cracked all this racism stuff for me. Yeah, and you know, so again, the Southgate High School where I went to had the largest, I think, Future Farmers of America chapter in the state. You know, there were 60 acres of fields and tractors that kids from Future Farmers of America would, you know, as one of their academic courses, they would be out there, you know, plowing the fields. You know, so that was the high school I went to. And we were notorious in Dade County. We were the smallest school. We had 600 students, the largest geographic school because it was all agricultural. And then we had this sort of arrogance that we were the countrified tough guys or something. I don't know what it was, but I remember I got into trouble by we went up and trashed Palmetto High School, our bitter rival just north of us, right? So a bunch of us got in cars and went up and tore up the school, and, you know, tore the signage off the front, and we got caught. And it was a long, long story. I was caught by the police because I left my books in a car. It's a long, 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 disgusting and stupid story. But, yeah, we were and it's so funny. I have a very good friend of mine, Bill Brown in Atlanta. I learned, a friend of a friend, who went to Palmetto High School and remembers when we went and trashed his high school. You know, those were the days, you know, when I was a recalcitrant youth, you know.
We all were.
We all were, I guess. It's amazing we survive our youth. I don't know. It's just amazing.
Right.
Yeah, I think life has life takes pity on youth. You know, it's a, oh, well, just let them go, you know.
Yeah. well, my father chased me in a car across the track, the high school track field to capture me and take me to get my hair cut.
Oh my God!
He drove. Oh. Yeah, he was a very conservative. He put on the image of being very conservative.
Right.
It was purely a front, but I mean he made a big deal of driving his car across the track field after me, and I was running to try to hide from him. I didn't
so what? You were trying to be a hippie and have long hair?
Of course. I was the only hippie in high school, you know what I mean? So
right.
I had to keep up the...
Got to keep up the image.
Well, I mean, the image, there was no image. It was like, you know, this is what a hippie is. He grows his hair. You grow your hair long.
Yeah,
you,
he doesn't get haircuts.
And you tell people,
haircuts, right?
You tell people, yeah, you tell people you're not going to go, you're not going to go to Vietnam. Fuck them. You know what I mean? That's it.
Oh, speaking
that
of
was
which,
about
I,
the same,
yeah.
I think that's the same. I think that might have been a reason I was sent down for the summer because I was 15, 16. I was becoming aware, and I think that's why I got I know my uncle in Florida at that time, the truck driving brother of mine, he went with me that summer.
Okay.
He went with me.
All right.
And my uncle was constantly trying to recruit us to join the Navy.
Oh,
constantly
my God.
That summer. And it finally came down to it. I would say no. My brother, my younger brother, he's younger than me. He was weak, if you ask me. He ended up joining the Navy, by the way.
He did.
He was weak, and I was not going to be weak. I said no, absolutely not. And finally, at the end of the summer, my uncle made the last pitch to me. You know, he says, "Well, look at this one, Mark. You're probably going to get drafted."
Right.
So the Navy is better than the Army. Just believe me, the Navy is better than the Army. So you're going to get drafted. You might as well join the Navy. And I
Go ahead.
For the second time in my life, I got on a jet airplane and flew back to Kansas, and I thought, fuck you.
He didn't convince me. The Navy.
Yeah,
and you never got drafted. What did you have a high number or what?
No, it was the last draft the last year the draft existed, and I was like 52 or 56. You know, it was pretty. Yeah, if it had been in effect, I might have gotten it. If the draft had been in effect, but I think I was the last number, last year. I mean, I waited. I mean, it was like literally within months after that number came that I. I think it was Jerry Ford, or I think it was they shut it down. That's all I know. They shut it down. So. But anyhow, so we've had a little trip there, courtesy of Henry Mancini. Not from Dixie. That's the name of that song. And evidently you haven't learned your lesson, and you're going to go back to Dixie.
Well, I don't consider Florida Dixie. That's what I'm saying. I consider Florida. You know, Dixie is like the Carolinas, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama. Texas,
Alabama.
Louisiana, for God's sakes, but Florida, you know, Central and Southern Florida is another animal. It's a very complicated animal.
Yeah.
But not that Southern agricultural South Dade County, where I was raised, isn't like a, you know, bastion of classic redneckism, you know, if you ever saw one, you know. You know, it's not. Florida's Florida. It's an incredible state, and that's why it's so overpopulated now. I mean, everybody wants to live there. The weather's warm and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, they do.
And, you know, it's probably one of the, pardon me, but one of the more corrupt states in the country. You know, I mean, look at this governor, DeSantis. I mean, the guy's shameful.
Yeah.
He's trying to out fascist Trump. And they're signing their own death warrant because this Walt Disney thing is going to really backfire. You know, Florida. I was aware of Walt Disney World, right? In the 60s.
Yeah, right.
My brother lived in Orlando, and I hanged around there. We know where it ended up, in Orlando. Well, in the 60s, this was the big, big, big news in Central Florida. Walt Disney, you know, had Disney World, Disneyland in Anaheim, California, of course. And they were going to build a huge Disney, called it Disney World, in around Orlando. And they got all this property, you know, hundreds of acres or whatever it is. And, you know, they started building this huge Disney World resort. So I remember talking to a bunch of construction workers that were in on this. So this was a real, real big story in Florida because Florida is basically, Central Florida is owned by the orange industry. You know, you'll be on roads and there'll be these hills, rolling hills, of nothing but orange groves. You know, it looks like tufted blankets, you know, with the little tufts and things. So the orange industry is huge in Florida. Remember Anita Bryant against the gays and all that stuff and back in the 70s? That was the orange industry that hired Anita Bryant. You know, we didn't want no homosexuals, and oranges are pure. We don't want to adulterate it with homosexuality and all that kind of stuff. So that was a crazy period. And then, of course, I think the biggest employer in Florida turns out to be Disney World. And there's all these other sort of resorts, Universal City, et cetera, hotels and blah, blah, blah. That whole central part of Florida is just massive resort. I remember a girlfriend and I were traveling from Tallahassee to Miami to visit my parents, and we were going to say, oh, what the hell, let's just stop at Disney World, and just, I've never been there. I'd never been there. This was the mid-70s. I said, we'll just stop. Well, we got there, and it was like, you know, you had to line up super highways to get into this place. It was so huge, and it was not something that you could just stop at for an hour, you know. It was something you had to commit the entire day to. So we completely blew it off and went by it because it was just, it's so huge. And one of the deals that they worked out with the state, because the state was delighted to have them, was that they could be their own incorporated, you know, government entity. And Disney would have its own police force, its own, you know, courts and things like that, to handle, you know, the normal little things of townships and whatnot. Well, that's the issue right now, that DeSantis has eliminated that, right? So that, you know, the people who live in this incorporated Disney area will now have their taxes raised because, you know, Disney is no longer providing fire for them, fire protection, police protection. Now the county is going to have to start its own police force. It's very, very complicated, and it's going to cost a lot of people more tax money. And so, you know, where is this going to go? It's a terrible idea. You know, just a petty little idea that he decided because they were against his reactionary Don't Say Gay bill. It's amazing. Anyway, well, we'll see what happens. It's going to be very amazing.
Well, it is amazing. And, yeah, Don't Say Gay. Is that – they can't be for real about that.
Well, that's the informal name given to it. You know, it's the whole idea now that you know, that just talking about homosexuality and transgender, that the teachers are, quote, grooming. This is a grooming exercise. They're grooming little children to be queers. It's this homophobic terror that, oh, my God, you know, they're grooming little Sally and Johnny to be homosexuals, you know. Well, it's nonsense, you know, look. But this is where it's going, and it's pretty reactionary, and it's pretty bigoted, and it's, you know, this is where we're at.
Well, I have yet to understand that. But.
Yeah, well. You have to understand it as a reaction of this guy who suddenly is on a roll. He thinks he can do no wrong. He thinks he will be out Trump in 2024. I think he's going to have a rude awakening. I don't think it's going to fly for him. Because, you know, he's got over 2 years before that presidential election. I mean, a lot is going to happen in those 2 years. So we'll see. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, he's very, quote unquote, highly educated, isn't he?
Apparently. He went to school at Harvard.
There you go.
That doesn't stop him from being, fascist stooges like what's his name, Josh
right.
Hawley. I think he's a Harvard too, you know.
When I hear that they're that educated, I immediately suspect they're con artists. I mean,
yeah, of course.
Who's that guy? The guy with the last name Kennedy. I think he's from Mississippi,
John Kennedy.
Or Louisiana.
I think
what
he's from Louisiana,
name.
Right? John Kennedy, and I mean, he is like Mr. Cornpone. He is just. You know, he should have a straw in his mouth whenever he's talking his stuff.
He's not real.
He's old school, and he's obviously a very smart fella, you know, and he knows how to twist all this stuff around. And of course, he is named John Kennedy.
Yeah. I just think, to me, it's like one of my favorite songs post Vietnam was I think it's The Who, and I can't play it. I would. It's copyrighted, I'm sure, unless I get a bootleg from a live concert, you know. But it's that one. What is that? We Won't Be Fooled Again. I think
I
speaking as a speaking as a deplorable. You know, I can't help but think that the Republican, the populist, the working class Republicans, the working class Republicans, should realize that the gigantic con of Trump should have at least put people on notice, like John Kennedy out of Louisiana, Ron DeSantis, all these guys that talk of shit rap on the working class are con artists. And I think you know We Won't Be Fooled Again, you know, it's that big the anthem of that one song about signs on the road or something, tell us what to do. That's a horrible thing to say, but the working class people in this country have been conned so many goddamn times. It's pretty pathetic.
Well,
I agree. You're the one who told me, but what about in the green room? What is the opposition? Yeah. Rather than the social democracy or the democratic socialistic attitude of the Democratic Party, you said you've got I Stand With Ukraine pro-war out there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's probably it's the colors of the flag, the blue and the yellow. And it says, I stand with Ukraine. It's a lawn sign. There'd be half a dozen of them around here in this suburb here. And this is, of course, what my pals on the far left would complain about is, like, these people are just watching cable news and, you know, they're getting all these horrible iPhone photos of weeping babushkas and the horrors, you know. All true. It's propaganda. The people on questioning this would call it propaganda, and of course it's absolutely true and accurate information on iPhones. But the point is, it's very moving because people are being abused in these images, and so therefore it incites a call for vengeance against the Russians for doing this and all that. So, you know, propaganda is flung around these days, and it doesn't matter if it's true or not. I mean, people think that propaganda has to be false and lies. Well, it's not. It's just, you know, what is it you're watching? What is it you're paying attention to? Who you're reading and who you're not reading? Is a lot of it, the sort of mainstream approach here is I stand with Ukraine, and I'm completely sympathetic to that because I watch enough of these images on MSNBC and CNN and whatnot, even Fox News. As I say, Sean Hannity is, a hawk against the Russians, while Tucker Carlson is is echoing the Russian propaganda lines. It's kind of confusing. So here we are, and all these lawn signs, I stand with Ukraine. And then you got the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State making a so-called, quote, stealth visit to Kyiv to meet President Zelensky. It was supposed to be stealth, but President Zelensky is always pushing this stuff, and he made it public that they were coming before they even got there. So it's on. It's like World War III is on, baby, and it's escalating. And the far left is. I've been listening to people on the far left for a month or plus. And, you know, they're blaming the United States for inciting this whole war by, you know, NATO in 1991 on pushing its way against Russia. And, you know, poor Russia when they lost the Soviet Union and, you know, and all that history. And here we are. And so who's to blame? I don't know. My view is a plague on both their houses. Somehow the killing has to stop, and then obviously diplomacy should take over. But hey, nobody's asked me, you know, so I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I beg to differ. You have your own.
Well,
you
asked me, maybe.
Right. And I know there's at least 220 people that every once in a
while. All right. Well, they're wised up.
But I mean, it's not a lot, but I mean, you've got, no. I mean, we're listening. Well, so you've got, I have not seen one We Stand With Ukraine sign out here where I'm at. Now, maybe
right.
There's some in the more affluent suburbs of Johnson County next door to us, there might be, but I haven't been up there for weeks. But you know, it does the Democrats no good by
right.
Going from be scared of Donald Trump
right.
to, well, hey, let's send $3 billion in military aid and fuel a war. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. I can't stand. I mean, to me, it's just like no matter what political party you're in, you're mm-hmm. you're sort of cursed. In this
right.
situation, it's like, you know, well, at least there's only two political parties. That's another problem with the United States that matters.
Well, yeah, but
there is
this, what I've been calling strange bedfellowship, if you will, that when you come to times like this with very confusing times, I mean, this is very different than Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam. I mean, this is not a brush fire war, a proxy war. I mean, we're virtually going to war against Russia. You know, I mean, they're trying to restrict it as much, no flyover zones, no troops, but every day it just gets worse and worse. You know, and it's not a pretty promising picture here. It just, I don't, and you say, oh, yeah, you want to help out the Ukrainians. But then at the same time, the question is, by arming them so much, are we encouraging more and more devastation against them? You know, and at the end, are we going to do the typical American thing, like we have betrayed every other person we ever had a war with at the end. We basically fucked them at the end and betrayed them. I mean, will that be our outcome with Ukraine? I don't know. And again, you know, nobody officially has asked me. So, you know, I mean, I'm joking, of course, but so who knows what's going to happen here? To me, it's out of control. You know, as I say, this strange bedfellowship, there is a sympathy between, and it's a little confusing and a little frightening to people, I think, at times, but there is this sympathy and crossover and strange bedfellowship amongst, you know, the Trump right populist movement and the far left populist movement that's very frustrated because it's been unsuccessful stopping wars for the last 40 years. It's been unsuccessful in doing a lot of its socialist aspirations and things like that. Black Lives Matter is probably one of the more successful movements on the left these days, but it's beleaguered and it's troubled with attacks from the right. And so, you know, the left is against the deep state and the right is against the deep state. And so there's a natural sort of footsie affinity between those two elements that where it will develop, I don't know, but it's something to consider and think about, I think. What it means, you know, what's this going to mean in 2024 by, you know, 2 years from now? what is all this going to shake out as?
Do we have that much time, do you think?
Well, we have 2 years before the 2024 election, obviously. But, the war is not going to ease back for a while, at least. God knows what's going to happen over there. But, that's only going to get more and more and more intense. And, of course, my friends on the left are only going to get more and more frustrated, exasperated, angry, and, and furious.
Well, are you saying to be opposed to war is an extremist opinion?
No. I'm saying being so opposed to war that you end up, without maybe even realizing it, becoming a belligerent in it, taking sides in it, if you will. In other words, I hate the American imperial history so much. I've been fighting against it in the anti-war movement for so long, and we've been fucked over for so long, and we haven't gotten anywhere because we got more wars than we ever had. And now look at this. And so, it's this, a plague on the United States imperial history. What happens is the left ends up so angry at this, it begins to parrot what Vladimir Putin is saying, that this is really a war against the excesses of the United States pushing against us. We had no choice. And that's exactly what the far left is saying. And they may be right. I don't know. But the point is, by parroting the Vladimir Putin's line about motivations and why the war is on, is taking his side, essentially, Although that may not be the motive of those on the far left. They may feel they have more honorable, maybe that's a bad word, but, that they're not operating in this way. I think it's in order to stop the killing, people who really have a peace in mind, you just got to stop focusing on blaming either side. Just stop the killing. And then we can talk about this. Now, that may be pie in the sky. I don't know. I don't have the answers here. I don't think anybody really has the answers here. That's what's so frightening about this. It has a life of its own. This thing has happened in the last, 3 weeks, a month? This is all new, happening very fast. And everybody tends to take a righteous position. Their position is righteous. I don't know, I think we're really in a real, real, real bad spot in the world right now.
So what is your opinion of recent Chomsky is getting flack from the left right now.
He's smart enough to take a larger view sometimes that does annoy. And, he's the one who said he was a libertarian socialist, And I said I'm a socialist libertarian, So he's a complicated fellow.
His latest quote that is tagging along throughout the internet and probably maybe is at 93, 90 years old. I don't know. He's in his 90s.
He says
we're approaching the most dangerous point in human history on the planet.
I think he's right. Yeah.
Well, that seems to be, if that message is not being sent enough, I think, to the warring factions everywhere, I think.
Yeah, but what, to me, which warring faction is worse? I don't know,
Do you ever, I know you have access to the internet, many of you do. I would strongly suggest checking out Telesur. That's TELESUR. And
that's
it's
Venezuela, South America, right?
Well, it's financed by several governments, not just Venezuela.
Right.
I think.
But it's South America. Telesur South, Sur South.
Yeah, you know? and I've been watching some of that lately, and I've been very impressed with the news coverage.
Sure.
Coming from the ground out there in Donbass and in the actual war regions, and their interviews with people, and it's got a distinct narrative that is not heard in the the mainstream media, but it's not.
Yeah, I understand it. Yeah. And I read some of that stuff. I just got a long article somebody sent. I get dozens of them every day, and I read some of them. And this was from something called the Orinoco Tribune. Well, Orinoco River is a river that runs through Venezuela, as I recall. So the Orinoco Tribune is, it turns out, I looked it up, you know, it's generated out of Bolivarian Venezuela, you know, with Maduro and all that, which is frankly, you know, I don't think it's out of line to say that it's going to give you the Russian line on this war. And, of course, that's what this woman was writing, and She had a whole amazing list of dozens of publications, including the Gray Zone, one that you cite a lot, which is good. I've looked at the Gray Zone; it's great. To get another perspective than the mainstream, you know, CNN, MSNBC, and that sort of thing, the New York Times. But again, it comes down to, who are you blaming for this war? Well, you know, whose side are you on here? Whose side are you taking versus the other side? Because they're mutually exclusive. It's war, so it's highly polarized, and there's no crossover. There's no diplomacy at this point, you know. So you're just getting a lot of information that becomes suspect. You know, I don't know if it's true or not. When the Orinoco Tribune, do I know the credibility of this writer? I really don't know. And I'm not in the Donbass, so I can't see for myself. And, of course, the Donbass is full of people sympathetic to Russia. So, you know, there's going to be... it's a situation of gruesome war in Donbass right now. It's terrible. Mariupol is a wreck. I mean, it's completely destroyed. what do you do? There's no backing away from that kind of stuff. I mean, this is total commitment. And it seems to be extending. They're talking about the Russians want to move into Moldova, which is another country than Ukraine. But it's not in NATO, so Russia feels it's free for them to go in there. It's just so demoralizing to me to watch it grow. And I mean, as I say, my view is a plague on both their houses. You know, I mean, the United States and Russia. I'm gonna say fuck it and go try to find my youth in South Dade County. You know. You know, silly little trip like that, you know.
Well, you might find a mixing pot there. You sort of describe a mixing pot of Florida and your youth, you know, with different. You were working and sweating in the orchards with people of different races and nationalities.
Well, we call them groves down there, not orchards. Those are apple orchards in New York. In Florida, we have groves.
Well, in Kansas, we have both. So,
just so we can pick.
Another thing, we've got only 15 minutes left. I wanted to shift to the Did you happen to see, it's on YouTube, by the way, the Republican prime in Pennsylvania, they had a debate, and it's coming up, I guess, May, in the middle of May is the primary. And they had a Republican debate for the Pennsylvania senator.
Right. Was that Oz
primary?
And McCormick?
Yeah. I mean, was that?
Well, I saw something from John Fetterman this morning about Oz and McCormick. And John Fetterman is pointing out that these are like out-of-staters, that Oz apparently is from New Jersey or something, and I think it was New Jersey, and McCormick is from Connecticut. Fetterman is suggesting their Pennsylvania bona fides comes up short.
He might have a point. Maybe.
He may. I've decided I'm voting for John Fetterman. I'm voting for John Fetterman.
Believe me, Dr. Oz, I have never equated to Pennsylvania, ever. I've only just seen him on TV. And, when he came out and decided to run for office, I thought, I didn't know he fucking lived in Pennsylvania, you know?
I don't think he does. Or he did. He probably has an apartment here or something, Well, you know, these days there's so much corruption going on that people get away with a lot of things, you know. That's what I think that's the problem, you know, with Trump saying he'd kill somebody on Fifth Avenue, that, you know, the corruption, ideology is no longer the issue in this country or the world. It's corruption. And it is so thorough, deep, and overwhelming that you don't know where to start to attack it. You know what I mean? It's just, it's in the flow. It's like in the system. I don't know.
So
that's just a feeling, I guess.
So it's a post-ideological world today, right?
Yeah. Well, look at Russia. I mean, Russia is more right-wing and capitalist and fascist than others, you know. I mean, the whole idea of the Soviet Union as a, you know, spurred from Marxism is just pure nonsense anymore, you know. It's all about power and money and wealth and all that kind of stuff. And of course, there is a new imperial struggle going on. And that's what Vladimir Putin is about, you know, cinching up his empire and, you know, with China and developing Africa and things like that. You know, there's this new imperial struggle, new great game, if you will, going on, that is picking up from the wreckage of the old ones, you know, with the British colonialism, American imperialism, and all the detritus of those periods. But now with, you know, cyber war and iPhone world and all this stuff, you know, God, what's his name, buying Twitter, you know, $44 billion. He's going to own Twitter as a private company. Well, I think this is showing this new multipolar world is not restricted to nation states. It is now open to, you know, Elon Musk, you know, the richest man in the world, to have the most powerful communication, you know, what does he call it, town hall or something, you know, town meeting or something, that this is going to be completely private, and, you know, so be it, you know, it is what it is. And so, you know, have the breakdown of this nation state, and power will be, you know, allocated based on other considerations rather than nation state dumb, if you will. And that, you know, oh my God. But, you know, that's happening now, you know. Oh, by the way, I was going to raise, yeah, what?
That's Putin. That's Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden.
they're trying to. I wanted to hit you on a story on page 15 of the New York Times today. It's from Kansas. Kansas court rejects congressional. What is this? It's a, you know, congressional map as partisan and racial gerrymandering. Are you aware of that? Big, big, big ruling in Kansas on gerrymandering by a district judge, Bill Clapper. He says, most Kansans would be appalled to know how the contest for House seats has been artificially engineered to give one segment of the political apparatus an unfair and unearned advantage, he wrote in a 235-page ruling. It's a big deal. And he's he waxed lyrical in the first pages of his ruling, citing an anthem about the moral strength of the residents of the, quote, the flat plains of Kansas, close quote, and musing on the meanings of democracy. You know, this is all very lofty stuff. And he ruled against efforts to set up the, you know, the gerrymandering in Kansas to favor the Republicans, grotesquely favor the Republicans. So they're going to have to redo those gerrymandering rulings. This is yeah, are you aware of that?
No. Who is this? Because I'll tell you what happened. When Putin and Biden called you on that phone, I heard the phone ringing.
You did.
It
that was nice.
Something cut me off, and I had to call back into the network. So I didn't hear it. But yeah, I think when Putin and Biden both called you at the same time,
okay,
I think it screwed up my communications. So what were you talking about? Who in Kansas?
Oh well, a federal judge, a U.S. federal judge in Kansas, a district there, has.
Yeah.
Thrown out of court, let's see, he threw out a newly drawn...
Is it a woman?
No, it's Judge Bill Clapper, district court judge.
Okay.
Threw out
okay.
a newly drawn map of congressional districts as unconstitutional gerrymandering. Intentional and effective partisan and racial gerrymandering. It was designed
oh, yeah.
to, you know, eliminate, you know, the classic eliminate black electoral power and that sort of thing. And this judge has stepped in and say, no way, you can't do this. You got to redo those districts. He leaned heavily on gerrymandering decisions in North Carolina and Pennsylvania, both of which went for the Democrats. You know, and so there's a lot going on in this, you know, these things. And it also...
I want to give the listeners the insight on that. All the proposed maps, all of them,
mm-hmm.
there's only one, I think, that's proposed by the Kansas Democratic Party, and it's
mm-hmm.
not even in the news. I mean, it's very to see it. But
right.
because basically they're not contesting. They're saying, can we just leave it the same as it is?
Uh-huh.
But no, the supermajority in the state house
right.
of Republicans are
right.
just flooding
right.
maps but one thing in common in all the maps is mm-hmm. they're trying to get rid of the Native American. They're gunning for Native
yeah,
American.
Of course.
A Native American congresswoman in the House of Representatives. Her name is Cherise
mm-hmm.
Davids. She's Native American
okay.
and lesbian. And a mud.
I remember
former,
when she was elected.
Russian.
I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it really terrified. It literally terrified these Republican lawmakers. And she also became a punching bag. A political punching bag. And all the
yeah.
maps are dedicated to eliminating the area, the cores, the urban cores of Kansas. That's the places
right.
where
well,
the
this,
oppressed
this,
where the people,
right.
the black and brown right. people live mainly.
Well, it's definitely an anti-urban sort of effort on the part of Republicans throughout the country,
oh, yeah.
not just Kansas. But at what you're talking about in Kansas, District Judge Bill Clapper ruled against it Monday, yesterday. He threw this out
right.
yesterday. So he told the Republicans that their gerrymandering efforts were unconstitutional and illegal, and they're going to have to do it all over again. That's what I'm reading this article saying. And he was very
Good.
Lyrical in his lofty in his defense of this, as, you know, this is an effort to destroy democracy. And he was he ponied up and said no. He was appointed, I guess, by probably Clinton or somebody like that. The, you know, the right wing is calling him a partisan Democrat, siding with Governor Laura
wow.
Kelly, a Democrat, of course. And, you know.
He probably was appointed. He probably,
yeah.
honestly, almost every federal district court judge,
mm-hmm.
federal district court judge in Kansas were appointed by Republicans. President.
Well, I don't think it says here who appointed him. It may somewhere.
Well, I got a good
yeah,
example
well,
here. The
yeah.
first black woman to be appointed a judge was
mm-hmm.
appointed by George Bush Sr. And she's still
right.
a judge in Kansas. She's in Kansas City, Kansas. Her
right.
court is. Her name is Julie Robinson. And she's mm-hmm. another one of these judges that are appointed by, I guess we could say, the old Republicans, who are now
right.
considered probably communists, the old
right.
Republicans are communists now, and
right.
the new Republicans. And
right.
the new Republicans are a word that nobody uses anymore. They CNN and MSNBC call them authoritarians. I don't know why they do that. Why don't they just say they're fascists? You know, you taught me a lot about what the word fascist means. I mean, I think a lot of these new so-called
yeah.
new Republicans, including Donald Trump, are just yeah. making hay out of fascist
yeah.
memes. And I think
I think you're right.
You know, this is a good example of how the old Republicans are unfortunately being, you know,
yeah.
is it a word, victimized? I mean.
Yeah.
Where did you get this article? Is this out of the New York Times?
This is page 15 of today's New York Times, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It should be
yeah. Well, it happened. The same thing happened in North Carolina and in Pennsylvania. The federal court, I guess it was, and maybe there were state courts in those, I'm not sure. But they both went against the Republicans. You know, the one in... Florida is egregious. It has yet to be taken to court, I guess, or saw. You know, it hasn't reached any conclusions in court, and we'll have to wait and see. But so far, you know, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, now Kansas, these judicial decisions have gone against the Republican efforts to, you know, racially. Block out Native Americans, blacks, whoever, you know, and especially, you know, this effort to, you know, empower rural districts versus urban districts.
Which are but in Kansas, that percentage of the population is like less than, easily less than 40% of the state. Easily.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't call it, you know, I live in a very sparsely populated area.
Sure.
One last question. We've only got a minute.
Yeah.
So are you saying, and maybe we could talk about this next week, listeners, tune in next Tuesday. So since the Black Lives Matter and the shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin by Kyle Rittenhouse being found not guilty, do you think mass demonstrations are no longer possible in the United States? Mass demonstrations of people.
You mean focused on the war or what?
Or anything. Yeah, especially the war. Is it possible to even...
Well, that's a good question. I don't quite... Yeah, it's not an easy question to answer because I don't know. But, there, you know, it may be bad the timing may be wrong, and I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. What do you think? Maybe we'll have to think about it for a week and talk about it.